Three, two, one. Borough employees helped fill the assembly chambers, wearing bright green buttons calling for a fair contract now. Many of them brought small children and their spouses, hoping to address the assembly early in the evening during citizens' comments. But another issue took up all the time that's allotted for citizens to have their say early. And when employees found out there would be a long wait before they could come to the microphone, about 70 of them made a mass exit and held their own meeting outside instead. Librarian Robin Smith gave the speech prepared for the assembly to her fellow union members.
We're asking for a 4.5% increase, which comes to 50 cents an hour per library assistant. While they'll still be at the bottom of the range of library assistants in the community, perhaps they'll begin to feel respected, something they haven't felt in many years. We believe our proposal is reasonable, and having bargained in good faith, we ask you, the Borough Assembly, to support our request. Management has consistently received raises. Now it's our turn. Thank you.
The current contract has been extended to August 15th, but the Alaska Public Employees Association says an impasse has been reached and employees are considering a strike vote. However, Finance Department employee Joanne Miller thinks there's still time to work things out.
I think that's probably premature. Nobody wants a strike. We really want to come to negotiations and settle this contract. We're already 6 weeks past the termination of the contract. A strike doesn't assist anybody, and so that's why we're here tonight, to let them know how strong our concerns are.
The borough's 225 union members have not received a pay increase in 5 years. The borough administration has offered a 2.5% pay raise in the first year of a new contract, 1.5% the second year, and nothing in the third year. Last night, assembly members met with the borough attorney, who is now working on a last offer to submit to the union Tuesday morning. That's also when the union plans to talk with the State Labor Relations Agency about holding a strike vote. But after last night's executive session, at least two assembly members indicated that progress could be made soon. Harold Gillum says the assembly is ready with a reasonable offer that he thinks the association will accept. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
From the opening ceremony with the lighting of the seal oil lamps and the procession of elders, it's clear this is more than an athletic contest. Actually, Olympics is something of a misnomer. Games of skill and endurance do take place here. Athletes do exert themselves to their utmost, and world records are set. But the strident sense of competition that leads to steroids and blood packing in international games is absent here. Minutes before they meet in trial, one athlete counsels her opponent on how to improve her technique. Another exhorts her keenest rival to strive harder. In fact, the entire context of the games seems to ground the athletes, winners and losers, in a deeper sense of culture, which is not surprising with games such as the knuckle hop and the four-man carry, games firmly rooted in centuries of tradition. In fact, for Nicole Johnson, who won the most gold medals in the games this year, the contests are only a small part of the game's importance.
It's really not, I guess, a competition. It is, but it isn't. Everybody enjoys just being around each other, helping each other out, cheering on each other. All of us are going for our personal best.
Nicole not only garnered the most medals, but was the winner of the scholarship and voted the best athlete of the games this year, which points both to the World Eskimo Indian Olympics origins as well as its continually changing face. When they began in 1961, women were barred from competing in the athletic contests, despite the fact that women in the villages traditionally took part in the games, says Reggie Jewell, who has traveled the state promoting the Olympics.
I remember showing some school kids in one of our villages the knuckle hop, and I was showing the boys' way of doing it and the girls' way of doing it so the girls would not get hurt. And one of the cooks in the school, who was a local woman, said, Reggie, how come you're letting the girls do it the easy way? I used to beat my brothers the other way.
By the mid-1970s, women were included in almost all the games. Reggie has seen a lot of changes in the 20 years he's been involved in the Olympics. He's been instrumental in expanding the games and educating others in them. He now has his eyes on new arenas for the competitions, including the other International Olympic Games. But he wonders what the changes will mean to the games.
It needs to go to the people that sponsor the Olympics. It needs to go to the people that make the decisions. And that's where it would take a lot of effort and probably a lot of compromise. And then I guess you run the risk of that game no longer being yours.
Homer Lord, who won the gold medal in the arm pull this year, is a good example of the game's past and future. He and his father hold a special place in the Olympics. Several years ago, they both won medals in the arduous four-man carry.
I came to these games, I was watching them, I saw him do the four-man carry, and I told my dad, you can do that, because we used to haul wood, and we used to pack moose and stuff like that, and I knew he could do it. I said, you can do it, Dad, go up there and do it. He went out there and won it.
For Homer, introducing the native contest at the bigger Olympics is a good goal.
I know that Reggie Jewell was on a Johnny Carson show, and one of his dreams was to someday see our kicking games or one of the other native games get into the World Olympics, the international games. I think that'd be something I'd like to see.
But for Nicole Johnson, the risk of closeness and familiarity pervading the games could be at risk if they expand into the wider context of world competition.
I'd like them to stay the way they are. Because there are games, we want to share them with people who'd like to watch, but I just feel that they should be kept here.
But whether they move from the Big Dipper Arena to the Coliseums of Seattle or Los Angeles, one thing is certain, the games and the culture of the World Eskimo Indian Olympics won't pass from memory or experience. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Booths in the Borealis Pavilion were still under construction Monday afternoon, but that didn't deter many fairgoers from taking advantage of opening night opportunities. Well after 9 o'clock, people were still lined up to get in, but by evening, the look of the 1990 State Fair was established. Fair manager Carl Amstrup says even with the hot weather to start the week, they're expecting a lot of visitors.
We budgeted for a turnout of 120,000 turnstile count. If the weather holds, we'll probably make that and hopefully exceed it. We budgeted for 275 commercial exhibitors, and we probably have 300 now, if everybody shows up that signed up, and most of them have. So from that point of view, it looks pretty good.
And one thing you can't miss at the fair this year is a politician. With 2 weeks to go before the primary, most candidates aren't missing the chance to get their names or themselves before the voters.
We have quite a number of political booths out here. And, of course, we're fortunate in that our fair comes before the primary as far as that's concerned. And the candidates can come out, you know, and have a one-to-one situation with the people from their constituency. And of course, there is no event in the interior that such a high percentage of the population attends. And so the politicians, the people that are running for office come out here, and it's a good opportunity.
Amstrup says the governor and lieutenant governor's debates on Saturday will be a highlight for those who want to see the top statewide candidates. The look of the fair has changed slightly with the loss of the Coliseum last year. This year, a huge orange and white tent stands at the Coliseum site instead. That's where several events are scheduled, including Monday night's crowning of the Harvest Queen. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. To get to know Alaska, Dr. Lewis Sullivan decided to pay his first visit here as part of the learning process. Sullivan stopped in Sitka before making a brief visit to the interior and then going on to Anchorage. He was accompanied by the director of the Indian Health Service. While here, Sullivan says he wants to learn what he can about the state and a personal visit is part of the learning process.
Clearly, this being the largest of our 50 states, you have very unique problems of distance, as well as some of the rugged terrain and the issues of geographic access that are very important, particularly during the winter and other times. Also, because of our very large Indian Health Service activity here in this state, we are very anxious to see how that program is working.
Sullivan sees several health issues to be concerned about here. Things like alcohol and drug abuse stand out, along with fetal alcohol syndrome. He sees that as a significant problem among Alaska Natives and believes better prevention of alcohol abuse will help that cause.
It clearly is a major problem that when a child is born with this syndrome, of course, that child may have a variety of problems, including mental retardation in some instances, so that from the beginning you have a child whose future development and whose future capability of becoming an independent, productive adult, as opposed to being a ward of the state, that child's capability or potential for that is greatly compromised. So we say that our first line of defense is really a prevention program to try and make sure that our population is aware of the dangers of alcohol abuse and urging the development of programs for alcohol prevention, as well as for treatment programs to try and help people beat the addiction to alcohol that is developed.
Sullivan also says he'll work on research for better treatment of the disease. Sullivan and his staff visited Minto as part of their trip here. Sullivan says that was really his first opportunity to be in the bush. He met the tribal chief and learned about some of the problems Minto has had with its water supply.
I was told by the officials in that village that since they moved from their prior location, some of the health problems they had before from contaminated water, those health problems have improved. They also seem to have a very effective childhood immunization program there. I met two of their village health workers who told me several times that they work 365 days a year, 7 days a week, 8 hours a day. So clearly they are very dedicated, if overworked, officials.
Sullivan says the trip to Minto illustrated the problems Alaskans have with access to health care, but he says residents there are meeting the challenge. The Health and Human Services Secretary also talked about funding for things like Alzheimer's research, which he'd like to increase by $5 million next year. But the reality is that the budget for HHS already takes up the biggest share of the federal government spending, some 38%. So he expects to feel some of the impact of budget deficit reduction efforts. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Booths in the Borealis Pavilion were still under construction Monday afternoon, but that didn't deter many fairgoers from taking advantage of opening night opportunities. Well after 9 o'clock, people were still lined up to get in, but by evening the look of the 1990 State Fair was established. Fair manager Carl Amstrup says even with the hot weather to start the week, they're expecting a lot of visitors.
We budgeted for a turnout of 120,000 turnstile count. If the weather holds, we'll probably make that and hopefully exceed it. We budgeted for 275 commercial exhibitors, and we probably have 300 now, if everybody shows up that signed up, and most of them have. So from that point of view, it looks pretty good.
And one thing you can't miss at the fair this year is a politician. With 2 weeks to go before the primary, most candidates aren't missing the chance to get their names or themselves before the voters.
We have quite a number of political booths out here. And, of course, we're fortunate in that our fair comes before the primary as far as that's concerned. And the candidates can come out, you know, and have a one-to-one situation with the people from their constituency. And, of course, there is no event in the interior that such a high percentage of the population attends. And so the politicians, the people that are running for office come out here, and it's a good opportunity.
Amstrup says the governor and lieutenant governor's debates on Saturday will be a highlight for those who want to see the top statewide candidates. The look of the fair has changed slightly with the loss of the Coliseum last year. This year, a huge orange and white tent stands at the Coliseum site instead. That's where several events are scheduled, including Monday night's crowning of the Harvest Queen. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
We have a plan to build a new Coliseum. It's somewhat dependent on what kind of assistance we can get from the state. We thought we were going to make it this year, but other things got in the way and got the money, and we understand that. But I think we stand a good chance of getting some startup money next year, and hopefully we can get the shell of a building up for the next fair, and then for Rendezvous 92, we hope to have it finished.
Among the issues that I'm concerned about are important here to Alaska are the problems of the high incidence of deaths from injuries that I understand is the number one cause of death here in Alaska, the problems with alcohol abuse, drug abuse, and fetal alcohol syndrome, and problems that are related to that, and other health problems that affect all of our citizens, including the ones here in Alaska. So it's a great pleasure for me to be here to learn as much as I can so that we can be aware of and sensitive to the unique issues that are faced in this state by the citizens of Alaska, so that as we develop programs and policies in Washington, hopefully the knowledge that we have gained about Alaska will be very helpful to us so that we can serve Alaska even better.
Three, two, one. The current contract ends at midnight Wednesday night. The borough's negotiator, Gene Hardy, made what he called the last offer today. It includes a larger salary increase and a new classification system for borough employees, all things that the union wants. But Hardy is also asking that some things already agreed to be changed again. And the union negotiating team isn't so sure about going back over things agreed to months ago. The borough's new offer includes a 4% salary increase this year and a cost of living increase of up to 5% for the next 2 years. But Hardy says paying for it could mean layoffs because the money hasn't been budgeted this year. So even though new employee bumping rights were agreed to months ago, he wants to go back to the old contract language. He says the financial situation has changed now.
We assumed at the time that we were going to have an agreement prior to the expiration of the old agreement. The assembly could fund a salary increase into the tax cap and it wouldn't be a big deal, so there wouldn't be all these layoffs that would have to be done. If there are any done, I'm not making a threat, I'm just saying it's a possibility. Well, that magic moment has passed, as I've told you several times. We are now got a fixed pot of money. There's no chance to re-up the mill rate. There's no chance to do a lot of other things that we had the chance to do then. So in operating under the premise that some of these salary increases are going to be funded through the mechanism of layoffs, we wanted to ensure that the amount of disturbance in the to the borough general government is minimized.
But after a closer look, union leaders were more concerned about other changes they discovered, changes in things that had already been agreed to. Alaska Public Employees Association spokesman Bob Watt says at first glance, it looks like negotiations have been set back 3 months.
I'm going to go through it and point out our problems and hope he'll take it and trash can it. If he is adamant on sticking with this language right here, we have been set back a long way.
Employees also aren't sure about the borough's formula to calculate a cost of living increase. And Bob Watt says salary is still an issue because the union's bottom line is 4.5%, not the 4% that's been offered. The APEA will establish procedures for a strike vote during a conference call Wednesday, and borough employees are getting ready to cash out their annual leave on Wednesday if there's still no contract. They're concerned they might lose that option after the contract expires at midnight. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3-2-1. Borough negotiator Gene Hardy started off with a salary offer, 4% this year and as much as 5% in each of the next 2 years, depending on the cost of living. A job classification system would also be put in place. Employees with upgraded jobs would get a retroactive pay raise based on the new job classification. Jobs getting a lower classification would reflect that only when a new employee came on board. Hardy says no current employee would take a pay cut based on the new classification system.
Filling of the positions changes, then we will adjust it accordingly. So it'll be done through attrition, not through taking it out of the hides or wallets of any currently employed individual.
But Hardy says layoffs may result from the salary increases because of a lean budget. So now the borough does not want to change layoff procedures, even though a change had already been negotiated and agreed to. Hardy says that tentative agreement needs to be changed because the situation is different now.
We assumed at the time that we were going to have an agreement prior to the expiration of the old agreement. The assembly could fund a salary increase into the tax cap and it wouldn't be a big deal, so there wouldn't be all these layoffs that would have to be done. If there are any done, and I'm not making a threat, I'm just saying it's a possibility. That magic moment has passed, as I've told you several times. We are now got a fixed pot of money. There is no chance to re-up the miller rate. There's no chance to do a lot of other things that we had the chance to do then. So in operating under the premise that some of these salary increases are going to be funded through the mechanism of layoffs, we wanted to ensure that the amount of disturbance in the to the borough general government is minimized.
But Bob Watt of the Alaska Public Employees Association, representing borough workers, told Hardy the changes set negotiations back 3 months. Looking over the borough's offer, union negotiators found differences in other things already tentatively agreed to by both sides. Watts was more concerned that the last proposal from the borough isn't going in the right direction.
We're going to read through these documents, point out to Gene Hardy our areas of concern and where they differ from our last and final, and ask him to make the appropriate changes in the document that he just gave us that will bring us back to an even keel, and hopefully we can get a contract. Now, I'm forever an optimist in this area, and I like to get upset a few minutes ago when I saw what he did. I'm thinking maybe that he's too busy to think about what he did. If he is adamant on sticking with this language right here, we have been set back a long way.
And even though the borough's salary offer went up, Watts says it's still not good enough. Employees' bottom line is 4.5% this year. And there's also some question over how the proposed cost of living increase for the next 2 years would be calculated. The contract expires at midnight tonight, and the APEA is already mapping its strategy. Procedures for a strike vote are being discussed today, and borough employees are preparing to cash in their annual leave, a benefit they're afraid they may lose if a tentative contract isn't reached today. Negotiators say what they got yesterday is less of a contract than what they have now. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3-2-1. Just how much more money the borough can afford to give its employees is the question. Union negotiator Leonard Dykes doesn't think money really is a problem for the borough administration. He says the 4.5% pay raise employees want this year will amount to less than $500,000, and he thinks the borough's got it.
Whenever they say there is no money, they have been, they've said that a lot. They come out and they give us I've got a big sheet in here that shows there is no money left in the borough, period. There's no place for a raise, so we can't have any. That was their position. Later on in time, down comes the state that says, we're not going to give you all your money, right? All of a sudden, they open a drawer and they find, what, $1.2 million? I don't understand. Someone's not, you know, I can understand they don't want to part with their dough, but geez, don't come right out and lie to us every time we turn around. I'm just getting confused signals. Every time that they seems that they're broke, they find money. That's been the history of the borough for the last 3 years.
Actually, the borough does have some money. Chief Administrator Rick Navin says money that wasn't spent last year and higher than anticipated revenues in some areas leaves about $3 million in the operating budget.
So our fund balance position is better than it might have been if it were just the way it was last seen by the assembly when they set the mill rate, which would have been $1.3 million total. What we have now is something better than $1.3 million in spite of the shortfall from the governor's veto.
$3 million?
We have $3 million more when you combine the money lapsed back into the budget and the revenue from last year.
But that's a far cry from the $7 million that the borough had in the bank 1 year ago. And Navin says more than $1 million to renovate the Fifth Avenue Center still must come out of the $3 million. Navin says the pay raise and job classification study, both things the union wants, must be paid for under the mill rate already set by the assembly. And he doesn't appear to be surprised that the union seems to doubt that.
There's an awful lot of distrust going on right now. Generally, the borough government has been encouraged by a number of allegations that have been made off and on cavalierly by assembly people. They think that the whole game of finance apparently is some kind of a game.
Employees met during their lunch hour yesterday to get the latest update on the contract talks. That's when they learned that a strike vote is at least 2 weeks away. First, a ruling must be made over who's eligible to strike. No strike vote will be taken until that question is settled. Meanwhile, union leaders are telling employees that the 4% offer from the borough is a ploy, a carrot being used to try to get them to accept the latest deal. They say it may look good, but what was taken away in the last offer will hurt in the long run. Leonard Dykes has no doubt that the borough can go back to offering the contract changes tentatively agreed to, as well as pay for the 4.5% pay raise that employees want.
You dang betcha. I think they could afford more. I think we're being real reasonable. Very, very, very reasonable. Because you look throughout the state, and I don't care whether it is, whether you're talking about state or universities or where you're talking, everybody got four, at least 3.8 up to, say, 4.8 plus bonuses. So if the rest of them can do it and the state says we're broke and they can do it, I see no reason that the borough here can.
We could come up with $3 million, but that leaves things a little bit irresponsibly hanging out there.
And Rick Navin also cites another factor that's entered the picture.
One might want to consider what we're going to do reasonably if the state maintains their position they're not going to plow Class 3 roads.
But yesterday, Governor Steve Cooper talked about just that issue during a news conference. Cooper says there is some flexibility in the state's budget, and he's got people looking at that problem right now.
Where there's demonstrated hardship, we're going to make every effort to make legal adjustments within the confines of the budget document. And we think we can do it. We think that we can administer this budget in a way that will not cause any substantial hardships to anybody.
For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Weeks of work produced the $2 million proposal calling for building transfer stations and remote pickup sites for garbage collection. The voter-approved bond issue was seen as a start to come up with a comprehensive garbage plan replacing the satellite dumpsters placed around the borough. But critics on the assembly say there are still too many unanswered questions. It's all been done in a hurry, and they can't justify asking voters to approve the start of something when they aren't sure where it will end. Assemblymember Donna Gilbert.
But I think it takes a lot more research in order to look at this and bring something really solid before the voters. And I will not ever admit that I feel like I'm wrong, and I very well may be. I said my feelings are that this was not ready to go forward to our voters. There just is not enough information behind it.
Gilbert helped defeat the ballot measure with the help of three other assembly members, Harold Gillum, Joe Ryan, and Walt Johnson. They also questioned the wording of the ballot initiative, saying it was so confusing people wouldn't know what they're voting on. The two assembly members who labored over the plan, John Davies and Hank Bartos, were disappointed with the outcome. Davies says the issue isn't as confusing as it sounds.
The fact is that people aren't doing their homework. They're not paying attention to what's going on. The idea was elementary. We put it before the voters. If it passes in both the non-area wide and the cities, then we can pledge the full faith and credit of the entire borough to pay back the bonds. If it only passes in the non-area-wide part, then we have to go to a special kind of bond sale where only the full faith and credit of the garbage district gets pledged. And then if it doesn't pass either one, then we go home. So, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. It's not too complicated. The legal language is complicated.
Davies and Bartos haven't given up yet either. The measure needs 6 votes to get on the ballot and just missed getting it last night. 2 assembly members who were absent could help swing things in the other direction. Bartos says when Assemblyman Chris Birch returns to town next week, he'll try to call a special meeting because he thinks then he'll have the support.
We did get the resolution through, and we had the full assembly here that voted for that, and if we had had those same people here tonight, the issue would have passed. I'm confident. I can't speak for how anybody else would vote, but I'm almost certain that would happen.
The assembly also killed another bond issue that the mayor wanted to put on the ballot. It would have allowed $5 million worth of construction and maintenance projects to be completed. But some of those projects were for school buildings, and assembly members argued that there may be state money to pay for those priority items, so they don't want to ask borough voters to pick up the tab. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
My understanding when we purchased this building was to split this thing with these guys half and half. And I told you that in 4 years, when we were able to move in there, if you didn't watch it, you weren't going to have any room to move a janitor in there. The school district was going to eat up the whole thing. If you guys haven't learned about the school district by now, I don't know what's ever going to teach you.
If you all think it was 50-50, I don't think you're listening too close, because it just didn't fit. It never did fit right from the beginning. What fit was just one fantastic deal. And this assembly jumped all over it like a cheap blanket. And now you're all quibbling about a few thousand square feet. Get your heads on and figure out where the coffee smell is coming from, folks, because it's coming from Juneau.
While the road closures and air quality warnings caused by Alaska's wildfires seem to be behind us, many of the fires smolder on, taking with them a sizable chunk of state and federal funds. Joe Rebar, a federal manager with the Alaska Fire Service near Fairbanks, says there are more than 100 forest fires still burning. According to Rebar, the unusually warm, dry weather that spawned and fanned the blazes continued into late summer.
The worst of it is generally over by now. The weather that we had a week ago or so, where we're in the 80s again, was extremely unusual. Usually by this time of year, we're looking at temperatures in the upper 60s, low 70s, and high relative humidities in the evening and stuff. But last week, with the high temperatures, low relative humidities, and a couple days of high wind there, it made the fires grow quite large in some areas. However, it looks the last weather briefing that I attended, it looks like we're starting to get back into a more normal situation with some precipitation, high relative humidities in the evening, and normal temperatures, upper 60s, like I say, maybe the low 70s.
It's Alaska's fourth worst year for forest fire, says Lynn Wilcock, the state's acting fire operations forester.
The highest fire season or the most acres burned was in 1957, when we burned in excess of 5 million acres. This year we've burned just slightly under 3 million at this point.
Wilcox says the hot, dry weather came in the second year of drought for areas like the upper Yukon, after a mild winter and a spring in which the snow evaporated, leaving little moisture behind. The state budgeted $3 million for fire suppression. When that was eaten up in a matter of weeks, Governor Cooper pledged that the state would come up with the funds to cover firefighting resources. Wilcox has the latest rough tally of costs.
State expenditures to date, about $14 million. And federal expenditures about $28 million, for a total statewide fire suppression expenditure of $42 million.
Federal fire manager Joe Rebar says a growing number of cabins in the bush added to the work of firefighters, but Rebar and Wilcock agree that the real problem was the unusually dry weather. Neither foresees any change in their agency's policies, which put high priority on the protection of property. Some of the fires now burning will smolder on until the snow flies, when the state and federal government will tally the total cost of fighting these fires. One victory, Rebar says, is that nobody paid with life or limb.
To the best of my knowledge, the last report we had, we'd had a remarkably few number of injuries. I believe it was somewhere between 130 and 150 injuries, with none of those being serious, mostly just cuts and bruises and slight strains, that type of thing.
In Anchorage, I'm Doreen Ransom.